I work as a piano tuner, as most of you know, and I was called out to a house on the east side to tune a piano. And this woman had five boys. And I started tuning her piano, and as I was tuning away, the boys watched me for a while, and then they had the good sense to go and do other things, because it's pretty boring work. But I noticed there was a YOU lesson sitting on the table, and I thought about the woman who had very graciously shown me to the piano and let me get started, and I realized that I knew her from Cleveland Services. We were a big group then, hundreds of people, and so I didn't know everybody, and we had just moved here not long before. And the woman was Lillian Hausen, and the five boys included Jim, who was a little guy taking piano lessons in those days. And it's fun and heartwarming for me to hear not so little Jim doing special music here. We're a team now. Jim Hausen and Mark Graham, we're the piano players, and we can't wait till the day when we add Claire Mango to our roster. We're waiting for that. That was back in days when Jackie Patchinger was here doing special music for us, she and her sisters. We didn't have to smile back then to look thin, we just were. But I remember at the time, you know, it was very important, and our church always emphasized it, and we still do to some event. There's a verse in Matthew 23 where Jesus tells us in end times that we have to watch. We have to watch events. And I remember when I came into the church, our news came from magazines, TV, radio, and newspapers, pretty much. That was it. We were kind of told what magazines to read. I remember I was reading a Time magazine, and my roommate who was in the church said, "Well, you don't read that, do you?" And I'm holding it, reading it, and I said, "Maybe." And I liked the... And he said, "Well, you know, we read U.S. News and World Report." Well, U.S. News and World Report didn't have any book or movie reviews in it, so I read Time magazine. But, you know, we were encouraged to get our news from good sources, television and radio. We did subscribe to a newspaper out in Missoula, Montana, so we could watch the news. And we stayed in touch with what was going on. Well, fast forward to 2018, Jim Hausen's now doing special music at services. The Stetters are now visiting us from Texas, and I wake up in the morning and I think, "No, I'm not ready for news. No, I can't do it." And so the morning goes by, I have my breakfast, and I work, and it's lunchtime, and I think, maybe I'll... No, I'm not going to check the news. No, it's just way too much. So then I come home at night and sit in my chair and think maybe now. And the dog comes up and wants to play tug of war. That seems like a better use of my time. But news nowadays, you know, I do stay in touch with it. But no matter what your political leanings are, no matter what nationality you are, these are different times. I mean, we've always said, you know, the end times are near, but things just seem different today. Mark mentioned, it just seems like a darker world. I'm glad that, you know, that people are still bringing children into the world, that they are marrying and giving in marriage, that life is going on. But at the same time, we can see clouds, figurative and literal, on the horizon. And it's hard to pay attention to the news. And for peace of mind, sometimes it's easier if we don't at all. And this is mentioned in Psalm 11. It's, you know, mentioned in many places in the Bible. We know in one of the letters to Timothy what the end times will be like. We know that they will get darker and darker. But in Psalm 11, in verse 3, there's a verse. In verse 1, it talks about taking refuge in the Lord, but in verse 3 of Psalm 11, it says, "When the foundations are being destroyed," and to some extent, that seems to line up with what I'm feeling, I'm seeing these days, "when foundations are being destroyed, what can the righteous do?" And in verse 7, it mentions, "For the Lord is righteous, and he loves justice, and upright men will see his face." Righteousness is part of God's character. It's something we have to do. And there's many answers to that question, what can the righteous do? But the answer that I want to talk about today is keep being righteous and how important that is, particularly now. It's always important, but how important it is, particularly in these times. I have the honor and happiness of overseeing our young people's Bible study, our teen Bible study, and we always start out our Bible studies with the Ten Commandments. I want to make sure that everyone in them, every person in our group knows the Ten Commandments and knows them in order, and the only purpose for the order is so they know which ones they know and which ones they don't know. But we drill them, and then we do the fruits of the Spirit, which really is, you know, another side of the same story. Ten Commandments and fruits of the Spirit are very closely related. But the question sometimes comes up is, why do we have to do this? And the answer is so that you will live better, so that you're equipped to be children of God, so that when times are tough, you have resources that you can use to be righteous. We know that righteousness is a huge topic, and you could talk about it for hours. We know that it's one of the fruits of the Spirit. We know that it's part of the armor of God. But all I want to talk about today is how important it is in these end times to continue to be righteous. And as Paul says in Galatians, you know, the law teaches us what righteousness is. That's why the law is important. Our goal, the goal that God has given us personally, is to become children of God and to become like him. But how do we know what God is like? Well, he gave us his law. And Paul, in Galatians 3, mentions, and it's a verse that you're very familiar with, that the law is a school teacher for us, that we don't know what right and wrong is until we have the law to teach us what right and wrong is. And that's one of the problems today. You know, I work at a university, and it was mentioned, I think Mr. Fader mentioned in a sermonette accurately, that universities are a great place for sin to live. They really are, because we're very accepting of all kinds of things. Now, I work for the Conservatory of Music, and in a way, we're a little more immune from that because our kids are too busy. They have more credits than anybody. They're practicing. They don't have time to sleep. And yes, they can be immersed in that life. The trouble with the university is we are taught, required, to be accepting of everything. We accept the new things that come along, and things that used to be regarded as unrighteous, we accept. The one thing, interestingly to me, that they don't accept and that they're not open-minded about is Sabbath keeping. Matter of fact, they'll say, well, you can't keep the Sabbath if you're a musician. How do you expect to get a job? And they have a point there, but it's interesting to me that that's one of the things that they're not willing to be accepting of. An interesting answer that I used to give them was that until the 1970s, the Cleveland Orchestra did not have Friday night concerts because so many of their members were Jewish from the time that it was founded, and they wouldn't show up for concerts, and so they didn't give Friday night concerts. It wasn't until later. An interesting part of history. But I'm familiar with unrighteousness all around. And you know, at least in the old days, which means when I was little, at least back then, people at least pretended to be righteousness. I don't think they were much more righteous than they were today. But we knew what righteousness was, and we tried to do it. And if you strayed into something that was unrighteous, sometimes people would say, don't do that, you know, or make fun of you, or beat you up or whatever. You know, there were various approaches to it. But nowadays, that's all off. We have to be accepting. And so it's more and more important that we know what righteousness is and that we adhere to it in these end times. Now, as I said, it's the law that teaches us how to be righteous. And so we have to know that. We have to measure ourselves against the Ten Commandments. And we realize at that point that we come up short. And as it says in the New Testament, you know, sin is the transgression of the law, so we find out how we're sinning, and sin leads to death. So righteousness is, in a way, a two-edged sword. In a way, it's what makes us unqualified to be the children of God because we can't be righteous. But thankfully, you know, there is something that God has given us and a path to righteousness. And interestingly enough, it starts, our knowledge of this starts very near the beginning of the Bible. We think of God giving us his righteousness, even though we're unrighteous, as a New Testament thing. And yet, the verse that starts this is in Genesis 15, and it's a very interesting, extraordinary verse. And I wonder if we even give it the consideration that it really, really needs. Because in Genesis 15, God is talking to Abraham. Now, bear in mind, God and Abraham have had a history at this point. Abraham's not new to God, and God's not new to Abraham. They already have a relationship at this point. But in Genesis 15 and verse 6, God is telling Abraham about the promises that he will make him. And right before this, he says, look up at the heavens. He made Abraham go outside. Look up at the heavens and count the stars. If indeed you can count them, so shall your offspring be. And verse 6 is very short, but phenomenal, because it says, Abraham believed the Lord, and he credited it to him as righteousness. Now, you can prove from the stories that we have about Abraham, and I thank God that my life isn't as written in detail in the Bible as Abraham's is, you can prove that he wasn't always a righteous man, that he made mistakes, that he sometimes didn't adhere to the Ten Commandments in righteousness. And yet, God counted Abraham's belief as righteousness. And together with this verse and a verse from Habakkuk that says the just will live by faith, those two verses are really the foundation of what Paul teaches us about righteousness in the book of Galatians and the book of Romans, which are very deep subjects. Thankfully, they're well covered here. And you don't need me, thankfully, to teach you that our righteousness doesn't get us anything. It doesn't get us salvation, but that God gives us righteousness because he sent a righteous son who paid the price for our sins. And yet, really, that story starts right here in Genesis 15, verse 6, this close to the beginning of the Bible. There is much more to righteousness than law-keeping. Righteousness is tied in with holiness. It's tied in with godliness. There's a host of words in the New Testament that refer to righteousness, godliness, and holiness, and yet they all overlap in many ways. Righteousness is part of the character of God. It's what we want to become. In Jeremiah 23, when we talk about the glorious end to this beginning of the story and the beginning of the rest of eternity in God's kingdom. In Jeremiah 23, he talks about those days and about the being who will come and restore that. The days are coming, Jeremiah 23, verse 5, when I will raise up to David a righteous branch. Righteousness is one of the main characteristics of this ruler who's going to come. It's also mentioned in Isaiah 11 that his belt, his garment, will be righteousness. He will be clothed in it. But here we are in Jeremiah 23. When I raise up to David a righteous branch, a king who will reign wisely and do what is just and right in the land, in his days Judah will be saved and Israel will live in safety. This is the name by which he will be called, the Lord our righteousness. Those days are coming when righteousness will rule. Righteousness is a happy thing. Righteousness saves us from making mistakes. One reason I want our young people and our old people and myself to have the Ten Commandments planted in our heads, and not just the Ten Commandments. I mean, they're aware of what Jesus Christ called the two great commandments. We cover those two. Is so that in times of trouble, we can quote them to ourselves. We know what they are. We know what we ought to be doing at that point. And my point, when the young people and I talk about this, is that righteousness will save you so many problems. Many, many of the problems and the difficulties in life come from messed up families. And if you obey God's rules, and if you honor your father and mother, and if in extension of that, you know, you honor your children, that you don't commit adultery, that you don't cheat on people at that point, strong, healthy families, strong, healthy marriages are a big part of a strong, healthy economy. Now, we don't do it for the money, but at the same time, one of the surest roads to poverty is divorce with children. That's not something that just our church teaches. That's something that economists teach, that's a burden on the economy, and it messes up people in major ways. And so if you stick to the Ten Commandments, you'll save yourself that kind of trouble. If you don't lie, if you don't steal, if you don't murder, you'll stay out of all kinds of trouble. And righteousness in the Bible is a happy thing. I don't even know if we're aware of how much we sing about it, but you know, in Psalm 1, and you know this is blessed and happy is the man, it starts out by saying, blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked or stand in the way of sinners or sit in the seat of mockers, but his delight is in the law of the Lord, and on his law he meditates day and night. And what's the picture we're given? We sing about it? He's like a tree planted by the waters, whose leaf yields its fruit in season, whose leaf does not wither, whatever he does prospers. And then in the last verse of Psalm 1, it talks about, for the Lord watches over the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish. And if you turn back to Psalm 128, which is like the height, the fulfillment of the way of life. I mean, it's even talking about God's kingdom, but it's also talking about today for people who keep his commandments most of the time, because it's not all happiness and sunshine. I mean, there are trials, as Mark was talking about. But in Psalm 128, it says, blessed are all who fear the Lord, who walk in his ways. You will eat the fruit of your labor. Blessings and prosperity will be yours. Your wife will be like a fruitful vine within your house. Your sons will be like olive shoots around your table. Thus is the man blessed who fears the Lord. May the Lord bless you from Zion all the days of your life. May you see the prosperity of Jerusalem. May you live to see your children's children. Peace be upon Israel. And if all the world kept God's Ten Commandments, which will happen, but there's no way it's going to happen before that branch of righteousness returns, then peace would be on Israel and every other country in the world, and people could raise their crops. We also know that we'd be blessed in other ways, you know, because the more righteous we are, the more we become like God, and that's what God wants. God didn't give us the law to show how bad we were and punish us. It works that way, and sometimes we need to be punished. There are punishments for breaking the law. He gave it to us so we would know how to become like him, and that's why when he talked about Abraham, it being counted as righteousness, Abraham was becoming like him. Abraham was a son of God, even back in those days. And when he counted in righteousness, who knows, that might be shorthand for saying that Abraham received God's Holy Spirit. There are many people in the Old Testament who were counted as righteous. Abraham's the only one that we have a record of. But in those days, to even approach God, to even come close to God, to even talk to God, after he closed up his office somewhere near the Garden of Eden, it says after that people had to call on God. He was gone. At the beginning, he was with them. When Cain and Abel were around, God made his presence known. But then, as I said, he shut down the branch office, and from that time on, people had to call on him. Well, the way you called on God was you brought him a sacrifice. And that's what we see when David comes to God, when Abraham comes to God, when Jacob comes to God. When these people come to God, the first time, there's usually a sacrifice. But then after that, there's not. God will come and eat lunch with them, or God will come and do a miracle, or God will send them a message or a dream or something like that, and God has a relationship with them. There's a man named Enoch in the Old Testament where it says God walked with him and God delighted in him. I mean, these were people whom God was already counting righteousness, even though the law technically would have condemned them. They already had God's righteousness. Remember that in Matthew 5, which is where Jesus is teaching people much about righteousness. Remember that he's talking about God's righteousness, and he gives us a plan of how to live in the end times. In Matthew 5, he says, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And poor in spirit are people who say, I can't watch the news right now because it's so depressing. I'm seeing all the terrible things that are happening, that people are doing to each other. He says, blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. We'll come back to that later, but these are times when righteous people mourn. He says, blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. And these are all related. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, which is what we need to be doing right now, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will be shown mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, which is another way of saying righteous, for they will see God. And that's our goal. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called the sons of God. And then an interesting verse about times before Jesus Christ returns. Blessed are those who are persecuted because of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And there are people these days who are persecuted for righteousness. That won't be in what we call the world tomorrow. But nowadays, righteousness, sometimes you pay a price for that kind of thing. He mentions in verse 20 an interesting a concept, because this is before Paul ever wrote his books, and of course Paul was taught by Jesus Christ himself. He says, I tell you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven. And the Pharisees were righteous in a technical way. They had human righteousness. They knew the law better than anybody, and they tithed on their seeds out of the garden. And yet he says that won't do you any good. So he's already saying that the righteousness that will help you enter the kingdom of God is the righteousness that helps you become like God and the righteousness that God gives you. I wonder if you've ever noticed, because this is our mandate in these end times. Of course, we have to preach the gospel. We have to make disciples of all nations. But as far as our own person goes, in Matthew 6 and verse 33 is a verse that we read all the time, and it's very important to us, and thankfully we know it well. But I wonder if we notice all the words in it, because it says, but seek first his kingdom and his righteousness. And we sing a hymn to that effect. Seek ye first. Seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things, which would be clothing and food and being taken care of, will be given to you as well. But we're seeking first God's kingdom, and we do that. But the righteousness that we seek, there's another word that modifies that, and it's his righteousness. So it's already being taught that our own righteousness is not what we're after. We're after his righteousness, and we're to be like God. You know, we sing a hymn called Be You Holy As I Am Holy, which of course is the same kind of concept. And holy is tied in with righteousness. It's the way that God is. You know, God is so righteous that if we were to approach him right now, we would be destroyed like someone going near the sun. He says that to Moses when he appeared in the burning bush, which was not, you know, God in his glory. It was God shielding himself so that he could talk to a human being on earth. The first thing he said was, take off your shoes and don't come closer. In other words, you're at peril just talking to me right here. The personality of God is so intense that it would just vaporize us, righteous or not. And yet there will be a time when we will, because we'll have his righteousness, when we can fellowship with him. And Abraham and his cohorts did it in the Old Testament. Abraham ate lunch with him. Paul talks about the difference between Moses and Jesus. And he says, Moses is the one who presided over the law that led to death. Jesus is the one who presided over the law and God's mercy that leads to life. And that's true historically, and it's true theologically. But I think in the world tomorrow, he and Moses are going to have to patch things up a little bit, because Moses might come to him and say, I talked to God face to face. I was counted as righteous. You know, you can say that I didn't understand that stuff, but don't blame me for the whole mess, because I understood a lot of it. And hopefully they'll go off and have a beer together and have a good time, you know, at that point. But Moses, we look on as maybe a harsh taskmaster villain. And Moses was a friend of God. God defended Moses and said, nobody talks to Moses the way I talk to him. Who do you think you are? So, I want to see that when Paul and Moses talk to each other in the world tomorrow. But it's very clear that righteousness is something that we have to build and maintain, that God needs righteous people, that God can't do his work without righteous people. Do you remember at the time when the Israelites had gone into captivity and were brought back into the land, that there was a man and a woman, an old man and an old woman, and they were characterized as being righteous? And because they were righteous, well, two things could happen. Because the man was righteous, he could go into the Holy of Holies and have a talk with the angel of the Lord. But also because he and his wife were righteous, they were chosen to give birth to a child who became John the Baptist. There was also a righteous young woman and a carpenter whom she married. And because they existed and because they were being righteous in the face of adversity, God could also use them. So it's important that we stay righteous so God can use us in these end times. You know, when he returns, it's said that our righteousness will be as fine linen, and white. I want to call out one example to you, which is in the book of Haggai. Now, Haggai is near the end of the Old Testament, and it's the last book of the Old Testament is Malachi. The book before that is Zechariah, and then the book before that is Haggai. It's a short book. It talks about historical events with the rebuilding of the temple. But the author of Hebrews makes it clear that this book is also prophetic and that the things that this book talks about are end-time events. You can check out the connection between this book and the book of Hebrews. But it gives an example, and this is a time when people are building the end-time house, the house that the Messiah will return to. And in Haggai chapter 2 and verse 10, God gives words to Haggai to teach the people a lesson, because they're working on the temple at this point, but there are problems in the society. And if you read the book of Ezra and Nehemiah, you know what some of those historical problems were, that the people were not obeying the laws of God wholeheartedly, even though God had brought them back to build the temple. And so, in chapter 2 of Haggai, in verse 10, on the 24th day of the ninth month in the second year of Darius, the word of the Lord came to the prophet Haggai. This is what the Lord Almighty says. Ask the priests what the law says. If a person carries consecrated meat in the fold of his garment, and that fold touches some bread or stew, some wine, oil, or other food, does it become consecrated? And the priests say no. In other words, if holy touches unholy, does the unholy become consecrated? And the answer is no. And that's correct, according to the law. Then Haggai said in verse 13, if a person defiled by contact with a dead body touches one of these things, does it become defiled? Yes, the priests replied, it becomes defiled. Then Haggai said, so it is with this people and this nation in my sight, declares the Lord. Whatever they do and whatever they offer there is defiled. Because when righteous touches unrighteous, the righteous is what gets defiled. So it's very important that we keep ourselves from the wrongness of the world. We still have to be in the world. You know, in the book of James and chapter 1, and this is the very brother of Jesus Christ, in the book of James chapter 1, he distills what he calls true religion. And again, there's more to living God's way than this verse. But he says, you want to know what you have to be doing right now? Do you want to know what true religion is? And in verse 27 of James 1, he says, religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this. And there's two things, two requirements. One is to look after orphans and widows in their distress and to keep oneself from being polluted by the world. In other words, fight to be righteous. Know the law and behave yourselves. And that way, we can be God's people, and we can do the things that God needs us to do. In Isaiah 61, there's beautiful verses about Jesus' ministry on earth, both the first time he came, and then it bumps up to when he will return. And these are verses that we know well. Jesus read them himself in a synagogue in Palestine when he was a young man living on earth. And in verse 61, he says, the Spirit of the Sovereign Lord is on me, chapter 61, verse 1, because the Lord has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim freedom from the captives, to release from darkness and release from darkness for the prisoners, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor and the day of vengeance of our God. And this part, and the day of vengeance of our God, suddenly that's the historical jump where it's talking about the Messiah returning, because Jesus cut off after the year of the Lord's favor when he read it and said, this is fulfilled before you now. So now we're in the end times, the day of vengeance of our God, to comfort all who mourn and provide for those who grieve in Zion. That's us. Zion is the called out group inside of Israel. And what it symbolizes is God's people today. And God's people today are mourning because they know what righteousness is and they don't see it around them. To bestow on them a crown of beauty instead of ashes, the oil of gladness instead of mourning. In other words, to give them the good news and a garment of praise instead of a spirit of despair. They will be called the oaks of righteousness. They will be, and oaks are symbols of strength that God will give us because we are living his way. We need to be oaks of righteousness, a planting of the Lord for the display of his splendor. And then it talks about various things, and that's usually where we cut off in this chapter. But I want to go to the very end, which is talking about Jesus Christ coming back and setting up his kingdom. And there's many ways to describe his kingdom, and we love them all. We need them. I mean, they're what sustains us. We have to read them to keep our spirits up. In verse 10 of chapter 61, Isaiah, talking about these end times, says, I will greatly delight in the Lord. My soul rejoices in my God, for he has clothed me with garments of salvation. This is a gift from God. And arrayed me in a robe of righteousness. It's God who arrays us. As a bridegroom adorns his head like a priest, as a bride adorns herself with her jewels. And here's the beautiful part. For as the soil makes the sprout come up, and a garden causes seeds to grow, so the sovereign Lord will make righteousness and praise spring up before all the nations. That's the time when we want to be alive, but we can live it now in our own way. We can have our own garden of righteousness in our own life. People may or may not notice. They notice more than you think, as Mark Scapura was saying. They notice when you are living righteousness. They notice the things that you don't do. They notice the things that you do. But it has to be part of our armor, the breastplate of righteousness, and we have to be wearing that fine linen. There's a well-known joke, older than I am. When my father was born, the president of the United States was Calvin Coolidge. And Calvin Coolidge was known as a man of very few words. He kept his wording terse and short as possible. He was known for that. And so it became a challenge for some people to get Calvin Coolidge to speak. And one day, Calvin Coolidge went to church services and his wife stayed home. And he came home and his wife said, Cal, what was the sermon about? And he said, sin. And his wife said, what did he say? And Calvin Coolidge said, he was against it. And I didn't get that joke when I was a little kid. It took me a while to understand that it was a joke about the way Calvin Coolidge behaved. Well, if Calvin Coolidge was here today, or if one of you goes home and somebody says, what was the sermon about? I hope you'll say, righteousness, we're for it.